Hello, I'm Jeremy Rivera, your unscripted SEO podcast host. I'm here with Adrian Donlin. Why don't you give yourself an introduction focusing on what you've done in SEO that should make us trust you as an expert?
Trust me because I am relatively new to it. And so what's normal to me is what's current, and I'm not stuck doing it a version from 10 years ago.
That's fair. Dinosaurs like me have a lot of baggage. It's interesting because for me, the more that it changes, the more it stays the same. But it's always a questioning periodically as the new shiny object comes out. Google is doing mobile first indexing, SEO is dead. Oh, it's voice search. Your iPhones are now the primary way that people are searching. SEO is dead. Google has integrated BERT and LLMs, SEO is dead. HCU came out and murdered, just stabbed a bunch of producing sites, topical sites of all qualities, and we can't figure out why. We can't bring them back from the dead. SEO is dead. To have more of a fresh take into it, I think in some ways could be an advantage. I'm curious what field or practice or marketing discipline you came from before transitioning into SEO, and what kind of prompted that change?
Yeah. First, I'll say on your point about as things change, they stay the same. I think I agree that the principles stay the same, but tactics kind of change.
Fair enough.
But anyway, yeah, I have a longstanding marketing background. I'm really a left brain and right brain, creative and analytical type of person. Like, my best classes in school were English and math. I loved to write. I did very well at math. I am a marketer with a data science background. I got a master's degree in applied data science, but I also really love fleshing out key messaging and developing a voice and a brand. I think that actually made me a good fit for SEO, even though I'm just a little over 3 years into actually focusing on SEO. It's like I love words and numbers, and SEO is all about using data to help guide creative content projects.
I can't help but notice that your bookshelves are organized by color behind you. So there's definitely an aspect of that left brain, right brain on display. But you're right. I have always seen SEO as, part science, part art. There is definitely a heavy data sciences aspect to it of, looking at trends, looking at, search volume data information, but also, the artistic capability to understand the flaws in the data and understand the incredible multi-layer, multi-tiered black box that we're playing with and for organic results. And now the addition of LLM-based oubliettes, who knows what will come out of the box this time. Is it even the same within the same person doing the same search at different points in the same day? It might not be. It probably isn't. And so all of those factors coming in means that you cannot project with hard science data protocols of confidence. If we're looking at A/B testing, which I've done for a larger agency, the ability to get to those confidence levels out of those levels of clicks is just not available in SEO. So how do you leaven your data side approach with that need for interpretation?
Oh, speaking of art, you use the word leaven.
Yeah, for sure.
Oh, beautiful, beautiful phrasing. The catalyst ingredient that makes the bread grow. I love that. Rise. Yeah. So, the most basic thing is just, you do your data analysis, you use your science to figure out what topics are most valuable for a website. But then to succeed at actually getting traffic to your content that targets those topics, and to succeed at then converting that traffic into some type of value, takes art, it takes storytelling. So I think that's like the simplest answer.
I love it. What is it about narrative and storytelling that is true today in the digital age that was also true, you know, in the 19th century? What's the through line?
The 19th century, you said?
Sure.
Yeah. I'll start with Simon Sinek. So his TED Talk, Start With Why, was one of the very first things that started to form how I thought about marketing. So I was first having to learn marketing just out of necessity for my own startup in 2011. And I encountered that TED Talk early on. And his main examples are Martin Luther King, Apple, particularly earlier Apple, and the Wright brothers, about how, like, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And I think underneath that is a suggestion that the most effective persuasion, the most effective communication happens when your message is in clear alignment with your personal and your values. So, like, people believe that the Wright brothers, like, cared, so like fiber of their being about figuring out how to fly. And then Martin Luther King, like, was incredibly authentic in his dream. And Apple, you know, it's probably a more complicated example, but at least their first 20 years, they were different.
Right.
And so when all of these people and organizations go out into the world trying to sell things, people believe what you're saying because it's in alignment with who you are. So that's, I always come back to Start With Why. I use that framework when I'm working on developing messaging with clients today. And I think that's basically a timeless idea, that any kind of communication is going to be more effective and going to be more persuasive when it aligns with who you are and appeals to some core purpose.
I love that, because there is, in my mind, always an inherent paradox of adopting authenticity as a marketing strategy, because is it your authentic self if you're packaging it, you're writing it, and following a template to authentically go out there and say something? You know, that there's that inherent, like, is it truly authentic if I'm intentionally crafting this messaging? You know, there's a manufactured element to all marketing, right? You know, like, there's messaging, there's choice. So how do you deal with that inherent, you know, conundrum of the falseness of just participating in marketing versus the need for that true connection of authenticity?
Yeah. I mean, I guess the proof is in the pudding. It's like, if it works, it's probably the best evidence that it's kind of like authentic enough that it actually appeals to an audience. And it's durable too. It's like one thing to give people like a sugary snack kind of a message that, like, you know, is appealing in the short term and like hits some need, some kind of dopamine, you know, craving. And that's different than the kind of message, ultimately a self-serving marketing message that continues to resonate for like years or decades at a time. That's going to be good evidence that it probably is authentic if it just keeps working.
How do you think, Google has made adjustments to its algorithm, has made steps that have made it clear, you know, particularly through the helpful content update, that it's not just the existence of the answer to the question. And, you know, I saw a site as an example of something that was hit by the helpful content update. They had done the research and had found every people also ask about Naruto, and then had created an alternate version of each of those answers and had built an entire site around Naruto and then plugged in a bunch of ads. And before HCU, it was ranking, but it was, you know, it was not like a known brand. It wasn't like Wired. It wasn't like even something that's, you know, very popular. It was something that was crafted or created because it could give an answer to it. And Google obviously came along and was saying, you don't actually, you don't have a brand. People don't know you from Adam. You're not, you know, a Reddit. You're not a type of site that people know. You're not Wikipedia for Naruto. There's no genuine activity there. You just have answered the question in a different way, which, you know, 10 years ago, totally acceptable, you know. So Google has basically been saying you need to have, you know, provable brand based off of the what we can measure as signals. How does that line up with your quest to be authentic, your quest to leverage good branding? How do those potentially come together for a positive outcome in your campaign?
Well, first off, part of being relatively new to SEO is I am not that well educated on the technical SEO, on like the algorithm of it all. And I'm not that up to date on changes. I rely on two members of my team who are really more technical SEO experts. So I couldn't even really summarize for you well what the like helpful content update actually changed. Do you want to like describe it for me?
Sure.
In the audience?
Yeah. So basically, Google was being inundated about 3 or 4 years ago. It reached kind of a critical mass point of, you know, it was before the big GPT boom, but not marketers have been using GPT like tools since 2015. And so there was more and more sites that were programmatic in nature and more sites that were ranking that had a bunch of content. And there was more and more, you know, travel bloggers and recipe sites out there, you know, kind of answering the same question. And what really shifted is they launched their own LLM-based portion of the search that was meant to combat. First, it was staged to combat other mass LLM content out there, but under the scope of, hey, if your site has a bunch of unhelpful content, then you actually get a negative penalty for the whole site. And if you have a ton of it, it will drag it down a lot. And so it was the return of a site-wide penalty, but from a very oblique, very difficult to quantify, is your content helpful or not? And so it's been, you know, when it first came, it came out in two iterations, two different algorithm releases, and then each periodic main core update to the algorithm has seen, you know, modifications to those sites that, you know, when there was a release, they would tank or they'd jump up. And the majority of those that tanked have really never actually been able to recover. I think it's maybe 1 in 100 have really come back. And wow, many of those are even just partial. Many companies went in down entirely. Many travel bloggers are no longer able to do their thing. A large swath of the content producing population, you know, really struggled with that. So that's developed at the same time, you know, that's their release of it and saying, hey, is there helpful content? Kind of also came at a time of like, what are they using to really measure that? Is it how the content is written that says that it's helpful or not? Or is it actually more about the perception, the user signals for their site to confirm that they really are actually, you know, somewhere where people, as a destination that people are going to and verifying, you know, because for the longest time, Google had lied and said, hey, you know, click behavior isn't part of doesn't affect rankings. And, you know, it's not a direct ranking factor. That word direct, you know, one of my previous interviewees, Jason Bernard, said that word direct in that sentence always gets you because if you're newer to this, you might take Google's statements from even John Mew, Eilish, any of them that make public statements, Danny Sullivan. There's a way that they speak and they talk about, you know, things in their algorithm that are are obfuscating the truth.
For
And
sure.
so they can say the truth. It's like fairies, you know, they say something that's true, but say it in a way that leads you to believe something that's false. And, you know, part of that is the echo game of, you know,
Like
SEOs.
the facts are true, but the narrative is false.
Yeah, it's like that because, you know, saying, oh, we don't use click behavior of how people interact with the SERPs and go through to your site. We don't use that directly or it's not a direct ranking factor. But in reality, the court documents that came out because Google got sued and the antitrust, they had it, you know, it's not just in the algorithm. It's one of the three major components of ranking. It's content, it's links, and it's behavior of how people interact with your brand as they do these searches. If
Which
you
I think
show
you
up in a search,
what better evidence would they have that content is actually helpful and useful to people than looking at the behavior on the site? That seems like a very positive thing.
It seems, but again, Google is very jealously, has been, and will always be jealous, the most jealously guarding of its secrets of how its algorithm actually works, because there is such monetary interest. There are people that will take anything and everything that they can to try to, you know, benefit themselves by getting things ranking very quickly through whatever shady means possible. So it's always been that way. And so I think, you know, LLM-based search tools kind of have this moment where they're coming onto the scene. They haven't been fighting with spammers for so long. And so, you know, they're kind of the new kid on the block, and their method of showing, you know, sampling it is inherently, you know, a lot more difficult to game out of the box, and the way that it works. But we are seeing right now a renaissance of, you know, black hats leveraging LLM tactics to try to manipulate. And we're also seeing, you know, Google itself acknowledge, or I think it was GPT acknowledge, that you know, with just 250 documents, you can poison a pool of data bias towards a particular result. So it's kind of interesting to see the rapid development, rapid adoption, you know, the beta test culture acceptance of LLM tools, and the error margin of these answers. I tell you, if Google had tried to roll out anything like the error rate of an LLM-based tool, even in 2010, 2011, their stock would have tanked. They would have been bankrupt, because the public consumer culture, the business culture, would not have accepted something that could come back to a life-challenging answer of, like, how far deep can you dive safely and get a wrong answer? That's just so dangerous that it would have been business breaking. Am I right?
I don't think so, actually. I'm just to dive down that rabbit hole for a moment. I think it would have been a big PR problem. Certainly there would have been less tolerance in 2010 or 2011 for inaccuracy. And I think there's less tolerance toward Google than toward startups like OpenAI about accuracy. But I don't think that would have tanked Google's business or their stock long term because of the power of their position in the market. And Google doesn't even have to be the best search engine. Google hasn't actually needed to be the best search engine for a long time, just because they're Google, because of their market share. They have too much power. They're the aggregator of information on the internet, and consumer behavior just changes very slowly. And people, Google is synonymous with search still. So I think that, like, Google's threats are much more infrastructure, fundamental, long-term changes, not like brand or trust, unfortunately.
I think the proof is in the pudding, the fact that they have rolled out LLM-based answers to so many of their questions.
And they're not perfect, but they're getting away with it.
I agree. But it does have a curious moment of some of the power, monopoly power of Google, has been pulled back to a degree, not entirely. And I guess that changes based off of who you talk to. So how much do you think, in reality, has the coming onto the scene of GPT, Perplexity, Claude, and others with LLM-based search tools. How much has that changed the marketing game in terms of, you know, budget allocation? Is it more of just the narrative of SEO is dead again, impacting CEOs who are then more willing to hear somebody say, well, we've got an LLM AI SEO approach versus we're just doing SEO fundamentals?
I mean, I have definitely have anecdotal support for that last point where, so I kind of ironically made the decision to go all in on SEO pretty much exactly as ChatGPT was coming out. Q4 2022 is when I was designed to go from more generalist marketing consulting, fractional CMO stuff to fully SEO, because I'd had a bunch of success with one client doing pretty traditional blog, like high volume blog output that was driving traffic and leads, and like 55-60% of their customers were coming from organic Google search. So I was pumped to like focus in on something. And then ChatGPT with, what was it, 3.5 that it launched with? Is that the model they started with? That was like November or something, 2022. So I've been focused on SEO entirely in the AI era. And it has been hard to sell SEO during this period because of uncertainty, not because the fundamentals had changed.
Right.
Maybe the fundamentals are starting to change now, 3 years later. But certainly for the first 2 years, fundamentals did not change at all. But there was just fear and uncertainty. And that made decision makers just want to invest in channels they had more faith in. So it's been hard to sell SEO. And as soon as I kind of made a shift in how I was presenting things and focusing more on AI in about July, so 3 months ago. And that was partly because I just felt like I had started to wrap my head around this growing quasi consensus about kind of how GEO works. And also I got excited about the basically like durability of an AI search offer, that even as like how the LLMs actually choose their sources and generate their answers may change, the offer of helping brands get mentioned by AI chatbots is going to be relevant for a long time. So I made that shift in messaging.
Yeah.
And also started to shift services a little bit. Basically, I learned about Reddit and started to offer like Reddit management, and started to build partnerships with PR firms so that we could pull those in side by side to help brands get more mentions, because we were hearing so much about how sites like Reddit, Quora, Wikipedia are driving citations, and how brand mentions drive mentions. So I had this updated offer, while our actual delivery still has not changed very much. But I just got a lot more meetings, like from my existing audience. People wanted to follow up. Former clients, people I've been in touch with a long time who had never bought from us, just people in my audience, like booked meetings when they started hearing me talk about AI, really appreciated my help framing how things are changing and helping them wrap their heads around it.
Yeah.
And I think ultimately the greatest reason for that was just that it gave them more trust in me, that I was able to talk relatively fluently about AI. And even if what we ended up working on was mostly traditional SEO website content stuff.
That's kind of what I'm seeing too. You know, the adoption of what should have been fantastic bedfellows all along of digital PR and SEO. Tradition, from my experience, this may be anecdotal and you can tell me if it's wrong, but I'd say that there is a pretty hard break between SEOs and digital PR folk, and only a thin sliver of, you know, the Patrick Stocks of the world of Ahrefs would talk about, hey, you know, some of my best successes come from getting newspaper stories placed. And you'd hear, you know, the Mike Kings of the world at a conference talking about, you know, these fantastic wins, while everybody else is focused on, oh, hey, can I get another guest blog placement? You know, can I find another place to do outreach to get a link? And it needs to be a DR 35 30x, you know, you know, hardcore focus on, if it doesn't have a DR, then it doesn't have any values. You know, I think that that thankfully has kind of shifted, but would you agree that till now, digital PR and SEO have not been the best play pals?
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's right. And they are kind of being forced together now, and that's probably a good thing.
I think it's interesting because I know people like Rand Fishkin, formerly of Moz, now with SparkToro, has been, banging the drum on unlinked citations and brand mentions since 2007, 2012 at least. What are some of those, you said, what are some of the actual tactics, that have changed? Strategy stays the same, but like boots on the ground, what some specific tactics that you've seen shift that have, brought success for you or your clients?
Yeah, two things come to mind. One is shifting the kinds of content that we focus on just away from the top of the funnel, which I can go deeper on. Another is just changing how we think about discovery online. And I use an analogy that AI is like a consultant working for your customer, and you're trying to influence how that consultant thinks, which means that everything on the web is kind of relevant. I guess start with content. This is, I think, pretty like well known among SEO folks, but the old blog tactics where you'd like throw up an article defining an industry term, which Ryan Law at Ahrefs calls rehashed Wikipedia content. That was always kind of an awkward phenomenon where like all these like websites are competing to become encyclopedias just to get traffic. When it's a much better user experience for AI to just answer the question when someone's just asking for the definition of a term. It's much less helpful to have that top funnel, higher volume keywords, what is blah, 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 jargon, that kind of blogging. And so much more focus on the bottom of funnel stuff, like all of the searches related to people looking for a solution, mostly in B2B, by the way. So definitely like more focus on really optimizing well for the high intent searches where people are looking for a solution. Plus, on the educational side of things, the like sliver of educational content that remains part of our strategy is the more niche stuff where an LLM is trained on the internet. It's got to do a good job of synthesizing commonly available information. But for people who are looking for a really niche subject where there isn't a lot of good content on the web, there's still an opportunity to kind of own that niche, own that long tail, particularly if it's like highly technical, if it's like hard for an LLM to come up with an answer on without having lots of context to train on. I was like, it's deeply technical in cybersecurity or, I don't know, deep tech or something. Then LLMs are probably just going to want to cite that source and or mention, basically use your answer and their generated answer, mention your brand.
Michael McDougall, the Brightthing agency, said ChatGPT is your least trained customer service representative. So it's detached from you, and you kind of have to use a fax machine approach to get new information into it. So if you kind of treat it from that perspective of, how can
I
you
think about it differently. So, because if customer service agent is still paid by you and accountable to you, even if they're not trained and they're really bad at their job, I actually, the analogy of a consultant works better for me. It really is working for the customer. It's like people subscribe, maybe they don't pay, but they have their own ChatGPT that's constantly updating more personalized context for them and giving them personalized answers. And is really a tool for them as an assistant for all of these decision makers out there. And it's our job, the same way you would like as a brand selling something within some niche industry, you would show up at a trade show to influence the way people think, knowing that there's like consultants and decision makers in that audience. It's now our job to help an AI that's using the internet to educate itself, to think about things our way. So we got to figure out where this consultant, this AI consultant, is formulating its worldview and show up in those places around the web. So if it thinks our way, then it's more likely to recommend our solution.
It's fascinating because for a long time, Google has said, don't write for search engines, don't write for robots, write for humans. But Matt Brooks of SEOteric just pointed out the other day, you are now writing for robots. And in many cases, you're using robots to write for humans. So it's like this robot sandwich, you know, like you've got human over here, you're using Claude and GPT to augment your marketing efforts to create content that's going to be digested by GPT and then given to the human end user. And so there's this kind of cloying game of writing how the robot thinks that humans want content to be written in a way that robots understand or can parse and can, you know, so it's kind of reverse engineering how these LLMs think that humans think versus actually writing truly for humans.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a little dark. Well, I think one potential vision of the future is that like websites are going to really go down in importance and influence, and just the amount of time that humans spend looking at websites is going to go way down. And, you know, there's people like, I hear people in e-commerce, which isn't really my world, talking about this, where they used to measure like a long recession was a good thing. And there's actually now people thinking about a sort of shorter recession as being a more optimal experience, because it shows that they showed up with sufficient context already to make a quick decision, and the website did a good job of optimizing for that quick conversion.
I'm wondering if that's a good thing or a bad thing for, you know, startups or entrepreneurs like Nexen, PowerTrack. They're trying to disrupt systems with new products that don't exist. And so I'm wondering if LLMs are more flexible, because I did that you know, in 2012, this guy, he had it was not a space heater, it was a space cooler. And like, it took like a year just to break in and get Google used to the idea that there was a product called a space cooler instead of like this juice product that was like cooler space. But, you know, we had to, you know, do adaptive marketing of like, it's not a swamp cooler, it's a space cooler. It's not a space heater, it's a space cooler. Do you think LLMs are more flexible when it comes to discovering new disruptive technology? Or is it more challenging because you can't control the inputs as well?
Like, basically, to phrase it another way, like, how quickly can you introduce new ideas into these tools' outputs? Is that what you're asking?
Yeah, kind of. Yeah, that's a way to put it.
I don't know. I don't think I have the experience to answer that question. I think, I mean, it's like, I've seen quick wins in GEO, particularly in less competitive spaces,
sure,
where you throw up a good article, and or like a media, and maybe supported with a media interview on a good authoritative site or something, and then you just like dominate a niche ChatGPT query. So I think my answer is probably temporal, where it's easier now probably with to influence AI, and as the whole industry, as basically marketing teams mature and adapt, it's going to get super optimized, and in a few years, in a couple of years, it's going to be a lot harder to win, in the same way that investment grew over time in SEO and it professionalized and became very competitive. I think that will happen, but there maybe will still be a little bit more randomness with AI and unpredictability. Overall, the bigger budgets will do better, but there will be maybe more exceptions and outliers.
I think that's a reasonable answer. And I'm thinking of my interview with, you know, Jason Bernard of Calicube, of his view that you have kind of within Google, and he's certain, you know, he proposed that LLM tools are developing this as well, of you have the training data set, you have their knowledge graph, And then you have the internet of citations that they can tap into. And so it's more readily easy to get influence because they're much more apt to check for broader amounts of citations, whereas the qualification to be, you know, cited in Google or used as a Google reference or a backlink leading to something, that's a much higher bar. So
I can give an example for this, actually. I have been hearing the claim that ChatGPT to trap referral traffic to your website from ChatGPT was much more engaged and higher value, higher converting than other sources, particularly Google.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been like hearing that as a rumor. I wanted to go find actual large sample research showing that. And I Googled that question, like a kind of, you know, long query, new age style query in Google, asking for research that showed this. And there was one case study. There was a blog with a case study from, I forget what, relatively well-known marketing agency. That dominated the results. Like, was this brand was directly mentioned in the AI overview. It was the number one citation of only like three citations. There was like three or four different ways that this brand and this article was showing up in the AI overview and the citations. And you go and you click through to that article, and it was a case study with one data point. This marketing agency wrote about the bump in engagement from ChatGPT referral traffic for one client. And so, like, that's not a good result. Like, we don't want to be forming our like sense of reality based on a sample of one. But Google ascribed so much authority to this one study. The cool thing, by the way, was that I got the attention accidentally of the guy who wrote the article on Reddit, and he immediately like added more client case, like they had more data and they added more client case studies to the article.
Well, that's good. It's as good as it is scary of like, hey, he had more data to back it up. But yeah, no, I had heard those rumors as well.
This was a Google problem, to be clear. Sure. Not the website's problem.
No. It is kind of an artifact of the day of like, hey, one person said it about one thing, and what would have been just treated as an anecdote because it gets cited in the LLM results in the AI overview, it's somehow now part of the accepted knowledge graph, and it'll be very hard for anybody to challenge that going forward. Because now it'll be counterfactual, you know, pushing back against an established data.
And by the way, there are other studies, and there were at this point a month ago or so, there were some other articles which I later found people showed me that did have the same finding about ChatGPT referral traffic and were based on larger data sets, and they didn't show up at all in that initial Google search.
So it is probably more true than less true that probably that traffic is more qualified.
Yeah.
I mean, you can follow the thread of the logic, but often, you know, just making presumptions, you know, that's not a scientific approach. It seems like we're becoming more prone to that as a culture of falling prey to a single data point.
Yeah. I mean, maybe this gets into bigger picture challenges, like just the amount of information we have access to, and that none of us can handle vetting all those sources and figuring out what's credible.
Yeah. It used to be very simple in 2005 to tell the difference between, you know, a crackpot site on GeoCities is not a good reference point versus, you know, MIT or Harvard. But now we have diluted authority so much. We have, you know, multiple inputs needed to get any particular data point out there, but also it's way easier to fake than ever. A bit of a downer note, but tell me what you're hopeful for as we kind of wrap this up. What are you looking forward to in marketing working with your clients or a success or something that you're kind of seeing that you're excited about?
I'm excited about AI. I mean, it's an opportunity for the flexible, the adaptable to figure out what it means for them, figure out what it means for your world, and learn and adapt. I'm excited to have the marketing, have GEO as like a subfield mature and develop some clearer playbooks. I still feel like it's so experimental. It's still experimental for the people who understand the very best and have access to lots of data, which means, of course, it's even more experimental for us small agencies. But I'm excited to see like more studies come out and to see more hands-on, like see kind of the more of these virtuous, mutually supporting programs of your traditional SEO and your like Reddit engagement and your digital PR, of seeing those things come together into like coherent programs, and see some of the like positive feedback loops that you can create among those tactics.
Awesome. Tell us a little bit about where people can find you, a little bit about your company. Is there a particular social channel you hang out on where people can see what you're thinking?
Yeah. Adrian Dolan is my name. My company is Search to Sale. SearchToSale.io is our website. In terms of social, I'm on LinkedIn the most. I co-host a podcast that's not really focused on marketing or SEO, but it's called The Shift to Freedom, which is a podcast for small business owners. And it's kind of oriented around mindset and strategy and personal growth. It's kind of like a holistic podcast for small business owners and managing themselves, managing their teams, managing their lives, managing their thoughts. We talk a lot about philosophy and core values and books and self-improvement. That's called the Shift to Freedom podcast. Everywhere you get your podcasts. Search to Sale, we're a B2B full service SEO and GEO agency, and we're particularly good at the data and strategy pieces of this puzzle. So we have our own proprietary software that pulls data from different sources, does your keyword research, and helps both plan and monitor content on your site. And then we're great at helping marketing teams then make decisions about like what is the next month's batch of content we're going to work on, and then planning pretty tactically page by page. We go through a whole checklist of things, including how to incorporate key messaging, how to optimize for answer engine optimization, aka like snippetable content, optimize for conversion and stuff. We're getting more into Reddit and digital PR and everything.
Fantastic. Thanks so much for the great conversation and your time. Make sure all those resources are linked in the show notes. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much.